morning. You're listening to Sophia on Expansion on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, www.republicbroadcasting.org. I am here today with a slightly hoarse voice because yesterday was the anniversary of 9/11. September 11th, 2001, which I think everybody in the world knows something about at this time. I was in Los Angeles, and I talked myself hoarse for about 7 hours at my table of stuff, which I have created. Since I was basically brought into this, you could call it loosely a movement, by a person whom I will refer to today as kind of my guru in 9/11, my originating source of much, very expansive information. It was possibly so much that I couldn't comprehend it in the beginning. I began contact with this wonderful wizard back in, I don't even know when, maybe 2004. Someone had sent me an article written by him, an essay rather, on the internet, and I read it, and it ended with the usual that many of us express when we have fallen down the rabbit hole, a sort of what are we going to do? How can this be improved, this state of shall I just say, depleted consciousness as to what is really going on in the world? And I wrote this wizard a reply. I wrote him an attaboy, and I said, just keep writing. Something will happen. I didn't know who I was writing to. I didn't know that this was a very well-informed former newspaper editor, someone who had written books, someone who was publishing on major information websites like Jeff Rentz, for instance. And amazingly, he wrote back to me, and I don't know why. I don't think he even knew why. He just said he had kind of a sort of prick of consciousness to write back. And we exchanged phone numbers, and we started to talk on the phone. So I know I'm keeping you in horrible suspense, but my guest today is John Kaminsky. And I will read a blurb from his latest book of internet essays. He has three: America's Autopsy Report, The Perfect Enemy, and then the third one is Recipe for Extinction, which is possibly the bleakest of the three titles. And it ends with a little blurb on the cover: a steadfast debunker of the phony story the government has told about 9/11, Kaminsky rails against the evil thoughtlessness that poisons so much of the world and paints the clear picture that all this needless trauma is really traceable to our own thought mechanics. And after the break, we'll be back to discuss that with our guest, John Kaminsky. You're listening to Expansion on RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network. The URL, www.republicbroadcasting.org. And this is Sophia, your host, and I am going to introduce my guest today, John Kaminsky. Are you there?
Hello, General.
See, I knew you would blow it. We have to explain this now.
I wanted to tell that story about how I first started calling you General is when I saw you really methodically, but with a great deal of common sense, putting together the component parts of this clumsy mystery that we've been dealing with for 7 years. And just your just your attitude and the personal habits you have that I know about made me realize that you had the potential to create a great deal of good and marshal a great deal of material and a lot of people into determining what you were after, which was the truth. And it has been my privilege for a long time to feed you information that I thought would help you. And I think I'm certainly a person who believes in what he says, but I tried to present you with the information that I had that was sensible and obvious, and boy, the way you put it together in 9/11 Mysteries really thrilled me, not so much for the accuracy of the material, but the being a writer and an editor and kind of a stylist, the style that you had putting together that movie was so precise and so beautiful that it is a distinct honor to know you.
Well, you're very, very kind, really, and thank you so much. It really all started, maybe. They say it all flows from the top down, and the student learns from the master. So I was learning from a master. But I have to say that you skipped something. I think you told me that you were calling me general because one day I'd be blowing a whistle and ordering a lot of men around.
Did I?
That hasn't happened yet.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I want to explain that I might trip into my name for John Kaminsky, which soon became Swami, and that was possibly because he behaved as though he knew everything. So I would just call him on the phone, and I would say, Swami, what about such and such? And he would give me an explanation. So anyway, I want to ask you about this needless trauma being really traceable to our own thought mechanics. This is the ending blurb on the back of your recipe for extinction.
Yeah, there's a link on my website, johnkaminsky.info, the new website. Death cult memes by Fishnet. When you look at that, you can see the mechanics of the way our society is set up. And somewhere between the Book of Revelation and the Talmud, there is this coding that seems to be resulting in our own deaths from just about every angle. I look at your chemtrail website, by the way, and that's just another angle and very well presented. It's what we believe is what we do. And if what we believe is that we can get away with anything and we'll be forgiven in the end, then we're going to do anything. And the people who created this scheme way back when, somehow, be it bloodline or philosophy, has come down to us in the present time where we're a two-tiered society now. We're predators and victims. And I have perhaps been a little too forthright in naming who I think the predators are, and that has resulted, because of the predator's power, in my exclusion from most areas of debate now, because I have come right out and said there is this one group that is controlling the rest of us and is lying to us about just about everything.
So our own thought mechanics would include our blindness to the presence of this group?
Well, it's invested with the concept of the sacred, where we're not allowed, because we are taught to be decent folk, we are not allowed to question certain things. Now, we learn, from the moment we're born, we learn everything from the media in one way or another, either through schools or through what our parents have learned. And what we have been given these past couple hundred years, certainly at about the start of the 20th century, is this steady diet of, we have this one group that has been a victim, and somehow the creation of that thought form, that there is this one group that has been victimized and should have a special status, that process has concealed a takeover of just about the whole of reality by this same group.
And the group is consists of many millions of people, right? So not all of them are part of the takeover. They're just part of the group by...
Well, just take a statistical, a significant statistical sample would be the people who control the finances of the world are manifested in this country, America, as the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is owned by 13 families, all of whom are Jewish.
Or purport to be. Now here's, you know, these are not really fine lines. I'm trying to understand broad concepts here. Are these religious people? Is this a religion?
No, I don't think it's a religion. It may call itself a religion, and it may, but it's more like a club, and I've called it a crime scheme, because in presenting themselves as needing museums to commemorate their suffering, they're creating in the minds of people an invisibility as to what they're really doing, which is owning all the industries in America, owning all the media, et cetera, et cetera.
So there are like two plays going on, the play of takeover and the play, I mean theatrical plays.
The takeover, the guise of oppressed victim masks the takeover.
Right. So, yeah, one stage is more in the forefront, that of persecution and suffering, and then you have the other stage where there's a much bigger drama going on, which is a takeover. It's like something, it's like a black hole. It's engulfing
everything. It's so big, it's so big when you try to talk to people about it, they think you're crazy because they've been brought up in an educational system that doesn't mention it.
And they can't see it.
No, and they definitely can't see it.
So that's part of the thought dynamics that you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, these titles of your three books of Internet essays, now, do you have the Internet essays up on your website where people can go through them chronologically?
You can get my old website at archive.org, and if you put the website name in there, all of my stuff is still available that way. But my active website only contains my recent pieces from the last 2 years, because they all kind of focus in on what I've determined is the most important issue that we all should be discussing. I mean, we can talk about UFOs and chakras and health and all this other stuff, but if we don't get at the political mechanism that is creating most of these problems, then focusing on all those other subjects isn't going to do us all that much good, because they're going to be destroyed eventually.
What's going to be destroyed eventually?
Well, all our opportunities for freedom, they're disappearing rapidly now, as you know, both health-wise and rights-wise. I've lost the thread of this.
Well, I'll just remind you of the title of my show. They are creating contraction. Our world is contracting. It's getting smaller. We have fewer freedoms. We have less of an opportunity to be ourselves. We are getting more and more conditioned and brainwashed and manufactured by this sort of operating system that has us in its clutches, all of us. And
yeah.
So for that reason, we ourselves have to create expansion. And the first step in that, I always say, is knowledge and understanding of what is happening. And we're driven by curiosity. Watch a baby. A baby is constantly putting everything into its mouth when it first awakens to its own life. And then it starts talking, asking questions and whatnot. But as time goes on, that the curiosity of that baby is marshaled into a groupthink, right? The hive mentality. And this hive mentality doesn't allow us to see what you're talking about. It doesn't allow us to see the hand that's controlling it and the nature of that hand and the intent and the agenda of that hand. So let's start with the three titles of your books. America's Autopsy Report, is that the first one?
It is, yes.
Okay, and it has on its cover a skeleton sitting on a coffin, and the coffin is draped with the stars and stripes, the American flag, and the skeleton has a hat, like Uncle Sam wears, stars and stripes. So is there a thread to this book in particular? Is there a particular thread to this book?
Everything that we hoped America would be and we were brought up to believe it was, was destroyed by 9/11.
All right. Well, let's pick that up on the other side of the break. We'll be back in a 3-minute time span.
Okay.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to Expansion on the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, and this is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking with my guest for today, John Kaminsky, author, internet essayist, shall we just say, wizard of information. That's what I found you to be when I first met you. And now we were just discussing the title of your book, and you were expressing that it was about everything that we believed America was being destroyed.
One of the essays I wrote in that was All Americans Are War Criminals. And remembering that got me thinking about the upcoming election, so-called. And there are two reasons why you shouldn't vote for either one of these candidates. In fact, if you do vote for either one of these candidates, you're committing a crime. You're committing two crimes. You are endorsing their views on committing mass murder in other countries, which makes you an accomplice to mass murder. And you are also endorsing a fraudulent election system, because almost everyone in America now knows that the votes are manipulated. They certainly have been, obviously, in the last two elections. So you are also becoming an accomplice to that fraud. The original essay in America's Autopsy Report, All Americans Are War Criminals, just stressed what is now an obvious fact, that Americans are willing to permit, and I guess always have been, the murder of innocent people in other countries as long as they can live their insulated lives and not have to think about what their country's really doing.
Yeah, and that's part of this whole thought mechanics thing. Now,
right.
I want to remind you, or listeners may not know, that in New York they did achieve their goal of 30,000 signatures. These had to be New York City residents so that they could put on the ballot, the November ballot, which is now, I think, going to be the 2009 ballot. Here we go with voting again.
Yeah.
An initiative that would permit an independent investigation of 9/11. And my first question was, how could this actually achieve anything? Because everything is so controlled. How do you know you're not going to get players in this committee that you put together that are going to overlook certain extremely, extremely glaring things that so far most people in the conventional 9/11 truth movement have tiptoed around? And the answer was, it's going to be a bona fide, independent investigation. There's going to be no corruption, no... you're laughing already.
Yeah, I fear. I was just thinking Elliot Spitzer's looking for a job. Maybe he could run it.
Well, the attorney who is organizing this is William Pepper, and I did go to L.A. in June to hear him speak at a fundraiser, and he mentioned something that I found very shocking. He said, well, we can start somewhere in 9/11 in a legal process, and we can follow the money. And he said, I will now begin to file, to initiate legal proceedings against two nations that we know to have been involved in 9/11. We have the Pakistani ISI, Mahmoud Ahmed, the chief of the ISI, handing over $100,000 to this character that we learned was called Muhammad Atta. We don't know who he really was. And that was the beginning of the money trail. Then there was a Saudi payment or funding as well. And I emailed William Pepper after this announcement, and I said, do you not want to think twice about suing Muslims for 9/11? Is this not falling into the same trap that we've already been, that's been laid for us, that Muslims were behind 9/11? There's another group that was involved in 9/11. We've got dual citizens of this country peppering the 9/11 landscape and the administration, and nobody's looking at them.
71 of them were flown out by Michael Chertoff.
Yes.
And without any kind of report or charges or observations, all we have is the apocryphal stuff from people who saw them performing that day. Where do you begin?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it does. There is a cloak over the consciousness here, and that's, I think, what you're talking about in this thought mechanic statement. You have your second book of essays is called The Perfect Enemy, and I remember when I asked you what that meant, you told me that the creation of an enemy that doesn't exist is an enemy you can never catch. Therefore, you can have endless war, and that enemy is Al-Qaeda, right?
Right.
So
Al-Qaeda is a division in a company where another division is also Blackwater. Al-Qaeda was created in the Philippines. It brought together money-hungry residents of various Islamic countries. Americans also went there. These people were brought to American military bases for training. Osama bin Laden was once in Nebraska under the name of Tim Osman. where am I going?
Well, we're going into the break, but I hope to come.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting Network. republicbroadcasting.org is the URL. And this is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking with John Kaminsky, who's giving us an overview of the origins of this 9/11 story and the group Al-Qaeda that we were told was responsible for the hijackings and I guess supposedly the collapse of the towers. I don't know how they figured that one out since it had never happened before. They were either extraordinarily lucky or engineering geniuses.
I was tracking a quote that was attributed to Richard Clark, the former National Security Advisor for Bush, who wrote a book called Against All Enemies. And I was reading an account of that on Pakistan Daily, the website. And I mentioned that because I tried to confirm it in the book and I wasn't able to. But in any case, this story said that Richard Clark in Against All Enemies had written that the Saudi royal family was really Jewish. Now, this is confirmed by Naeem Jalati, an Iraqi author who wrote a book about the subject, the Wahhabi sect of Islam, was founded in the 13th century by an Iraqi Jew. Incidentally, Joe Biden is an Iraqi Jew. The citation goes on to say that not only was Osama bin Laden Jewish and the Saudi royals were Jewish, but that Al-Qaeda was really a Jewish organization where various Arab criminals were paid to foment violence, and that this was what Al-Qaeda really was. Now, whether Richard Clark really said that, I know Pakistan Daily said that, but it got me thinking about the Saudi royals, who do not behave like any Muslims that I know. They have exorbitant houses and yachts and hang out in Monte Carlo, whereas all the Muslims I know are more community-minded.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you know other Muslim royals? You have to look at the same socioeconomic level here. You're talking about royals.
I know no other Muslim royals.
All right. So you can't really say, like, any other Muslims I know, because don't we have to compare apples to apples here?
Well, I'm just talking about the behavior in general, where the bin Laden family, members of the bin Laden family were visitors to Bush's ranch.
But don't you think this is all in the courtship of oil and oil? When people have oil money, wouldn't they spend it? Wouldn't they send their kids to the best colleges in the country that was buying their oil from them? And wouldn't they
go to
tourist sites? It's very interesting to me that you've now, you're examining the other face of some of these Islamic groups as they've been set up in our minds. That it's hard for me to believe that the Saudi royals were Jewish. Why? I'm not denying it. I have no basis on which to deny it. I'm just trying to swallow it figure out how it could possibly come to be. Now, why would Jews set up a Muslim? How does it work? Which is the chicken and which is the egg?
Well, I think the Jews are the chicken in almost every circumstance.
So they became Muslims on the face of things.
Well, they created much in the same way that Scoville and Darby created an evangelical Christianity that was friendlier toward Israel.
But Scoville and Darby weren't Christians to begin with, so they created another sect. When you go from one theocratic religion to another, and you suddenly wear the robes of a whole different religion. We're taught that the big monotheistic religions are Judaism first originated, then Christianity and Islam about 400 years later. So how does one hop from one to the other?
They all have the same basic structure, that's how.
Okay.
And they all have their own individual narrator, the principal character.
Well, I'm wondering if there would be a political reason to suddenly don the costume of one of the other.
Funny you should mention that.
Yeah.
What culture, what tribe, if I may call them that, goes into a host country and assumes the demeanor of the residents of that country and winds up taking over that country?
Gypsies.
No, I don't know of any countries that gypsies have taken over.
True.
There's one culture that's done it down through time. It's the same culture that has been kicked out of all those countries for manipulating the money and loan sharking, basically, is why they've been kicked out. Funny, we're having financial problems now, isn't it?
Well, yes. I wouldn't call it funny, but I think this is all part of the design. The gutting of Germany was one stage of things in Europe. It seems that Germany was a very promising country at one time, and then it became completely windless, flattened, and now we have America. The same thing is happening to America. We had great promise here, great industry, people power. We have no industry. It's all now in the Far East. It's all being shipped out, and there's a shell left, And this is the autopsy that you are talking about. And what happened to the body that caused it to die? We're in the death of America. We are it. We're experiencing it.
Yep.
And I think so many of my mainstream, I won't even say the word friends, because there's really no friendship left. There's an acquaintance situation. But they believe this is cyclical. Their real estate will go up again. And
oh, my.
It's very, I cannot prove that this time it's the vortex that we're in, and it's not going to be a cycle. You can't just wait it out. You have to.
No, it's a complete change happening.
You have to make a plan for weathering the contraction of your own life and lifestyle and possibilities. And you have to create your own expansion. This is the little formula of my show. So we have the perfect enemy, Al-Qaeda, which is an enemy you can't catch. But I don't, so Al-Qaeda was, it's a real entity, you're saying.
It's a group of CIA and Mossad recruits.
Okay. And things are blamed on them out of convenience. They act as another mask, another level of the mask.
They're the designated enemy to be feared and pursued.
Okay. So then the third title, Recipe for Extinction.
Yes, I probably shouldn't have picked such a depressing title because it hasn't sold well. But it's I've just always written things down as I've seen them. And what we see coming at us, no matter what kind of personal optimism we can muster about our own personal situations, looking at the larger sphere of things, seems to me that everybody is at greater risk than they've ever been in their entire lives for losing everything.
That's bleak. I opened the book before the show and I saw something. You know, I didn't finish reading the book, but here's some. I will finish it now because I saw this essay in it and I'm going to read from it. It's called Warmth on a Winter Night. And the subtitle, From Beginning to End, A History of the Universe in 15 Minutes. So I know you've done vast amounts of research in all different nooks and crannies, and I would even say on many different planes, because there's, I guess, levels of history, levels of anthropology, archaeology, what's the science of the universe?
Cosmology.
And you have written about all those different things. One of the things about the Kaminsky essay is that it floats and it drifts, but it's extremely potent, and it will take you from paragraph to paragraph into these pockets of almost, it's your own bewilderment, trying to understand where does he get this from. I almost wish there were footnotes to everything, every string that you play in this writing, so that I could understand what note is that, where does it come from in this particular song. So here's a quote. On the time scale of the greater universe, the time it takes to begin to think about raising your finger and striking a key on this keyboard encompasses all of human history, past and future, from the flint that caused the first spark that ignited the first bit of kindling, that heated the first felled wildebeest, that fed the first nuclear family in the first gathered community, to the last bomb that was dropped that killed all living beings on Earth, because as on Mars long ago, it popped the atmosphere like a soap bubble and turned the planet into a lifeless frozen cinder. Then 5 million years passed and life began anew. Now what does that mean? What happened on Mars that popped the atmosphere like a soap bubble? Or is that metaphoric writing?
A little New Age material slipped in there, I fear.
You see?
There is a José Arguelles, the Mayan time guy, writes in one of his books that talked about Babylonian death fear. the asteroid belt, and this is a common New Age concept. The asteroid belt used to be the planet Maldek, and it blew up because of some, I don't remember the reason. And these same legends talk about how Mars once had a civilization, and they blew theirs up and lost their atmosphere in an instant.
So that's slated to happen here?
Well, I think it's a possibility here. I think of HARP when I think of that. We're tinkering with the atmosphere. We don't really understand the resilience or consistency of it. We're just tinkering with it. And what if we blow it and it pops?
Well, there's this thing in Switzerland. I don't even know. I'm so fuzzy.
The Large Hadron Collider.
Right, that is capable of creating a black hole that will engulf us all. So.
Right.
Yeah, so that would be...
To look forward to.
Well, then all our problems, that someone told me this last night. He said, I won't have any more problems. Everything will go away.
I wrote a piece one time called Cultural Wormhole.
Yeah.
And we were transiting from one kind of existence to another, but I hope it's not a real wormhole, and I don't know. I think that the worries about the Hadron Collider are not real.
Well, when you write these essays and you weave in a little bit of New Age, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, are you doing it for literary reasons, or does this reflect your study and the sort of integral scaffold or architecture of what you're trying to write?
When I'm actually writing something down like that, I'm not really conscious of where it's coming from. It's just pouring onto the page.
Okay. Now, we have a book in common, the Ernst Becker book, Ernest Becker, I can't remember.
Ernest, yes.
Ernest, The Denial of Death.
Still my favorite book.
Yes. Would you tell us why? What is that book really saying, The Denial of Death? You began in the beginning of this interview with a thread from that.
Yes. And there's a quote from there on my website, at the top of my website, that's kind of my guiding path. I won't remember it now. God, I'm bad at this. Once you base your whole life striving on a desperate lie, you instrument your own undoing. In our belief and quest for eternal life, this is not his quote now, just the first sentence. As long as we pursue things for the reason that give us eternal life, we cannot fail to lose our focus on the planet and the life that we are living. We're no longer able to actually see how we're actually behaving, because we have based our whole perceptual system on a lie, which was invented by humans and claimed to be from God in all instances, unless Zechariah Sitchin is right and it was dictated by aliens. But I think that's just another work of fiction.
So explain this, that lie being... The lie that we're predicating our whole existence on and wiping out our responsibility for our actions.
Yes.
What is the lie?
The lie is that we go to heaven or that we come back as somebody else.
Okay, so you're basically saying that's it. We go into the earth and that's the end of us. And it's all
that is it. Humanity cannot contemplate its own non-existence. We cannot see beyond our own death. Every description that has ever been written about it, including the people who've gone to see the white light and the angels, that is all human projection.
Why are you so sure?
It can't be anything else.
Well, why does everyone have the same thing in common? I mean, Maoris...
Because they all have the same desperate fear to overcome.
Okay, but the people in, you know, natives in New Zealand and Australia, Aborigines, they see the white light, they see the tunnel, they see folk dressed in white flowing robes with blonde hair. Now, why, they've never seen pictures of white people before.
The point I'm trying to make is that the focus on what that might be and the structures that that has created take our focus off accurately seeing who we are, what we're supposed to be doing, if anything. And it just, it skews everything, and it also gives rise to these structures that control our societies through things that we know are not true. And we're forced to believe things that we know are not true. We're forced to believe Jesus was born of a virgin. We're forced to believe Mary Magdalene saw him come out of the tomb. We're forced to believe all these things that are not true. And if we're forced to believe things that we know are not true, like the 9/11 myth, then we're going to engage in behaviors that are further iterations of that disease, of that lie.
All right, we're going off for another short break, and we'll be back. Listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is internet essayist John Kaminsky, who was my guru when I entered all this, this rabbit hole, and who now has been ejected from certain web platforms because of his rather radical views, and he's giving us one. Just got into it, which was, I suppose what you're trying to say is that the religion we've been offered and we choose to believe, at a certain point, I don't know if it becomes forced or one is actually acting out of choice. Or do you have a comment to make on that?
Well, I was going to provide a modern analogy for what I was talking about before the break. 2 million people are dead in Iraq because everyone believed that Arabs had done 9/11. And what I'm saying is, believing that initial fact causing the 2 million dead is akin to believing in you can die for your country and go to this happy place. Believing that causes behaviors that have created, I don't know if created is the right word, but certainly have sustained most of the wars in history of people believing that they are fighting for a holy cause. And holy causes are invented by strategists in religious and political institutions, and the two always come together, to cause all this mayhem that afflicts us. That's my take.
Right. So the cause, holiness is being attached to the cause. The cause is really the device of manipulation. And holiness, as holiness is siphoned often into the cause, then people regard the cause with that much more enormity and importance. But as you talk about how certain things cannot be possible, there's a very sort of stark, oh, well, this is the end of the road, folks. And people have had these experiences of, you know, spiritual or religious experiences of light and God, and people have seen, you know, from Elvis Presley to Jesus himself walking
angels
into...
Angels and aliens,
yes.
Yeah.
And I suppose that could be a collective human hallucination that visits some of us at some point in our lives, and then we rave about it because it's so extraordinary and everyone else believes that that is possible. I suppose you could define it like that.
Our government is a collective hallucination, I'll tell you.
All right, but you're spoiling my thread here.
Oh, sorry.
So then you write on page 128 of this recipe for extinction, "This is the new American paradigm, both a fear of independent self-determination and a horror of not being part of the crowd. People are afraid to think for themselves and to question what is being rammed down their throats as consensual truth." So there's a consensus that we are, I think, heavily indoctrinated to be a part of. I believe we're at our top of the hour break. This is a short break, and we'll be back on the other side in a minute or so.
Okay.